Bien, eh bien voilà, nous accueillons donc maintenant la deuxième et dernière, pour le moment, conférence de Jason Bedoun, qui va donc nous parler des nouvelles recherches sur les Kefalaya de Dublin, dont, sur lequel il a contribué à un premier ouvrage qui vient tout juste de sortir, enfin, qui est sorti tout récemment, Mania the Court of the Persian Kings, et est en train, avec d'autres, de travailler à l'édition complète de ce qui est déchiffrable, c'est-à-dire, semble-t-il, à peu près un cinquième de l'ensemble, mais ce qui paraît déjà miraculeux, étant donné ce qu'on pensait au début de l'état de ce corpus. Voilà, donc sans plus attendre, je lui passe la parole.
Thank you. I'd like to thank Professor Franz Grenet for the invitation to address you here today. And I'd like to express my gratitude for your hospitality and for the true friendship and love in all its forms that I have been shown in the last 2 weeks. In 1929, a major discovery of Manichaean text was made at a site called Medinet Mahdi in Egypt, known in the Roman period as Narmuthis. A small chest was found buried in the floor of an ancient house containing 7 papyrus Manichaean codices written in Coptic. The find included early authoritative writings by Mani and his first followers. These were the first intact Manichaean books ever recovered and included 3 of the largest codices known from antiquity. But time had been unkind to them. The papyrus was badly degraded, with fragile pages sticking together into solid blocks, and darkened to the degree that the writing could be read only with great difficulty. After their discovery, the Medinet Mahdi texts were sold on the antiquities market and came to reside in 2 collections, one in the State Museum System of Berlin and the other in the Chester Beatty Library, now in Dublin. Among the surviving Medinet Mahdi codices are 2 volumes of Kefalaya, that is, topical chapters on aspects of Mani's teachings, ostensibly collected from the oral tradition of the Manichaean community immediately following Mani's death. The first volume, now in Berlin, began to be edited before the outbreak of the Second World War. This publication has added exponentially to our understanding of Manichaeism and has formed the documentary basis for a sizable body of books and articles exploring various aspects of the religion. The second volume, the Dublin or Chester Beatty Kefalaya, was in much poorer condition. It did not attract the interest of editors before now. But in 1986, a photographic facsimile edition of it was published by Soren Giversen, and a few pages were in good enough condition that short passages could be read. The Collège de France's own Michel Tardieu published the first 2 articles on the contents of this elusive manuscript by drawing upon readings from the facsimile. His pioneering work was followed by an important study by Werner Zundermann. The astute insights of these 2 scholars, based on only a few passages of the codex, have been confirmed and expanded upon when the work of editing the complete manuscript was finally taken up in 2008 by a team consisting of myself, Ian Gardner of the University of Sydney in Australia, and Paul Dilley of the University of Iowa in the United States. It is our expectation that the completed edition and translation will be published in 2017 or 2018. A volume of preliminary studies based on selected of the passages of the codex were published last year, as Professor Grenet already mentioned, the Mani at the Court of the Persian Kings. And my remarks today will, in some part, introduce you to things that are expanded on at greater length in this volume. And in other ways, I'll introduce some new elements of the contents that might pique your interest. As part of this project, we've been able to obtain a carbon date for the Medinet Mahdi codices based on a variety of samples and place it no later than the early decades of the 5th century. The second volume of Kephalaya continues the chapter numbering system from the first volume in Berlin. But as Professor Tardieu already surmised, its content is quite distinct. For one thing, the two codices carry different titles. The Berlin Codex is entitled The Kephalaya of the Teacher, whereas the Chester Beatty Codex bears the title The Kephalaya of the Wisdom of My Lord Manichaeus. While the Berlin Codex contains mostly monologues by Mani on core Manichaean doctrines delivered in response to questions from unnamed disciples, the Chester Beatty Kephalaya appears to be almost completely dialogue between Mani and various figures most identified by name, who typically represent rival authorities from the religious, philosophical, and political realms of Sassanid society. Many of the debates take place at court, at times with the Emperor Shapur as witness, but other passages are set in Mani's missionary travels in what is today Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. The topics of discussion here are rarely the Manichaean mythemes that dominate the Berlin Codex. Rather, we see Mani taking up the concepts of other religious communities or general issues of philosophical debate, such as the createdness or eternity of the world, in order to best his opponents, prove his superiority, and win their conversion. In short, we are witness to what Professor Tardieu has termed a catechesis of conversion. Mani is shown engaging with these figures in their own terms, whether philosophical or religious, whether in Christian terminology, or Buddhist, or Jain, or Zoroastrian, or the generic folk wisdom of popular sages. In each case, he demonstrates mastery of the respective established measures of authority. His wisdom is tested and demonstrated, and his spiritual authority recognized as he successfully lays claims to all prior traditions. In other words, the Chester Beatty Kephalaya is a narrative of legitimation, systematically relating Mani to traditions of spiritual succession. This is what Tardieu means when he speaks of the Codex as having its main focus on prophetology. By the end of the Codex, before it turns to Mani's passion and martyrdom, Mani has proven his claim to follow in the footsteps of prior prophets and to be the fulfillment of their hopes. This kind of religious cosmopolitanism appears to have been a program of both method and message in the Manichaean movement. We have with Mani an initiative to integrate religious and cultural heritages across the map. Mani did not have to leave the confines of the Sassanid Empire to carry out this program. It was a realm that already bridged west and east and encompassed a spectrum of religious identities. Mani was in the right place at the right time to articulate a new global vision inspired by the extensive reach and rich cultural dynamics of the new Sassanid order. The result was an almost unique religious universalism expressed in a manifesto of religious supersessionism preceding the similar claims of Islam by 400 years. Our knowledge of West Asian religious history in late antiquity has been handicapped up till now by large gaps in our sources. Let me give you some examples of this. The classic compendium of Jewish traditions, the Babylonian Talmud, was compiled after the rise of Islam. Recent scholarship has demonstrated that it cannot be treated as a simple record of late antique figures and teachings, but is a highly contrived early medieval work of literature. To this fact must be added the growing realization that rabbinic authorities did not represent the majority of Jewish communities in late antiquity, but only built up their influence very gradually. There remains a large, unknown face of late antique Judaism waiting to be recovered in the gap between medieval rabbinic Judaism and the relatively good documentation of Second Temple Judaism of more than half a millennium earlier. Then we have the problematic state of our knowledge of pre-Islamic Zoroastrianism. It is well known that the surviving religious literature of this religion dates to medieval times, the 9th through the 12th centuries mostly. This literature claims dependence on pre-Islamic material, but this claim needs to be carefully dissected. If the ritual texts of the Avesta were in effect frozen in time from a period approximately 1,000 years prior to Mani, and not committed to writing until very late in the Sassanid period, and the medieval compendia date to 1,000 years after him, we are left with two millennia of intervening religious history and development for which the evidence is remarkably slim. Some external descriptions of Iranian religion, a set of religio-political inscriptions from Kartir from the late 3rd century, a not very informative numismatic record, a few religio-political relief carvings, and a great deal of ambiguous archaeology. The challenge for scholars, such as my good friend Professor Grenet, is to try to interpret the archaeology without the benefit of contemporaneous texts. Can we rely on the continuity of belief and practice with texts that are either much earlier or much later? The situation turns out to be much the same as we proceed further east to South Asia. Here, religious and philosophical texts are all dated by convention rather than confirmed dates. Whole histories of Hinduism, Buddhism, and Jainism are constructed based on relative chronologies, typically linked to a string of assumed dates with hardly anything concrete to anchor them. Inscriptions are of some help, but Professor Gregory Chopin has called attention to how little the inscriptional evidence is heeded, and how much this material demonstrates the weakness of historical reconstructions based on the texts contained in much later manuscripts. We actually can verify very little about the development of Buddhism and Jainism in India prior to the early medieval period. Some Buddhist manuscripts dating probably to the first couple centuries CE have been found in recent decades, but they are scarcely representative of what must have been a very diverse movement. From there, we must wait for Chinese visitors to give us any datable information on what it looked like in India in the 6th and later centuries. So all of this, which must sound very sweeping to you and would need to be qualified in various small ways if we had time, is meant to suggest that we have a very substantial gap in our knowledge of religious history in pre-medieval West and South Asia. Emblematic of this state of affairs is the puzzle and uncertainty over the artistic program of the 6th century tomb of the Sogdian Werkhok. Knowing even a little bit about how religious identities were defined around him would help tremendously in deciphering what these images are meant to convey about his religious convictions. How fortunate it would be if some source was found that helped to fill that gap and that gives us even a small window into what these religions look like and how they interacted in late antiquity. This is the reason why the Chester Beatty Kephaliah is of such significance. An Egyptian manuscript from the late 4th or early 5th century containing a text that probably can be securely dated to a century earlier, reporting through some literary retouching events which took place in mid-3rd century Sassanid Iran. This text is valuable not only for what it tells us about the formation of Manichaeism in the lifetime of its founder, or as that formation was understood in the first few generations of his followers who compiled the text, but it's also important for its many references to the other religious traditions with which Mani became familiar as he consciously sought out the religious heritage of his world. Now we have confirmation and expansion of what Kartir's inscriptions hint at, that contact among all these religious traditions was going on in the 3rd century within Greater Iran, which proves to have been in some ways a uniquely cosmopolitan religious culture. For 100 years, we've had Manichaean texts that, for example, quote Zarathustra, or which use Mazdaiznian terminology to convey Manichaean ideas, or which appear to know elements of Mazdaiznian literature, otherwise known only from late medieval manuscripts. But all of this material that we've had for this time is in Iranian languages and texts that date to 9th or 10th centuries themselves, roughly contemporaneous with the great renaissance of Mazdaiznian literature in the post-Islamic period. The Chester Beatty Kephaliah as a manuscript pushes the date back to the late 4th century and as a composition to the late 3rd century. Plus, when it cites Mazdaiznian or traditions related to the figure of Zarathustra, when it cites such ideas, they cannot be dismissed as local regional accommodation the way the appearance of such material in the Iranian Manichaean texts might be. It clearly reflects ideas considered worth transmitting to a completely alien culture, that of Coptic Egypt. The same can be said about Buddhist references in the later Turfan texts compared to references to both Buddhist and Jain traditions in the Chesterpiti Kephalaya. So let me focus on a few examples that make it clear that Mani and his first followers were deeply and seriously engaged with the religious traditions of Sassanid Iran. I'll start with Kephalaya in 341. And this is a passage which talks about Mani's comparison of words from what is termed the law of Zarades, Zarades being a common form of the name of Zarathustra in this literature, but a comparison of words from the law of Zarades with teachings of Jesus. This passage has two important implications. The first, already drawn by Paul Dilly, focuses on the detail of quotations drawn from a law of Zarades as evidence of a written body of Zarathustra literature in Iran in the 3rd century. This would mean that even before the invention of the Avestan script and the careful transcription of Avestan ritual texts, other sorts of teachings had been textualized in the Middle Persian or possibly Parthian vernacular and were accessible in a kind of zand. But the second implication involves the whole scenario in which this exchange in Kephalaya 341 takes place. It is an Iranian layman, Papakos, who quotes to Mani words from the law of Zarades, and then goes on to say that he has heard, quote, from your disciples, unquote, the words of Jesus. The scene described here suggests the place of Mani and his followers as the initial Christian mission into Iran, and helps us to see Manichaeism as the acculturation of the Christian movement to an Iranian cultural sphere. What we are used to thinking of as simply as Christianity is, in fact, the Christian movement acculturated to a Greco-Roman cultural sphere. Manichaeism looks different, and so is viewed as a heresy, or in less polemical terms, as a syncretism of Christianity with Iranian religion. But Orthodox Christianity is no less a syncretism of an originally Jewish Christian movement with Greco-Roman religious themes, concepts, and values. The exchange with Papakos captures the conditions in which Mani's Aramaic, Mesopotamian-rooted form of Christianity began to engage with Iranian religious material. Mani's actions in this situation are very interesting. He does not dismiss the law of Zarades as error or falsehood, but contends that it is in harmony with the teachings of Jesus. And this will become his programmatic response in most similar situations. That is, to affirm prior religious traditions and find points of agreement between them and his own teachings as an apostle of Jesus. Another example of this engagement with Iranian religious tradition is the way in which the Manichaean alms and food ritual was presented as the true meaning of the Zoroastrian fire ritual. We have among the Iranian Turfan texts passages that interpret Zoroastrian ritual symbolically in light of Manichaean teachings about divine light trapped within the world and its liberation through the alms brought to the sacred meal of the elect. But we do not know the author or date of such passages and how much they might represent a later local adaptation to Central Asian Iranian culture. But Kephalaya 326 in the Chesterpiti Kephalaya now gives us substantially the same interreligious engagement in the mouth of Mani himself. Speaking to a judge named Adarbat, Mani explains the ritual of gathering fire from house to house and bringing it to the great sacred fire. Its true meaning, he says, is the gathering of alms for the ritual meal and the fire that is in food going to the great fire which is in the sun and the moon. This, he says, is the Eucharist. He also addresses certain branches, which may refer to the Zoroastrian barsal, and says that they symbolize the commandments. So this is an additional passage not discussed in the book where we see this engagement with Iranian religious culture. My third example is the great surprise of finding a version of a story well known from the Shahnameh, where the legendary Kai Khusro abandons his throne to go off in search of higher things, disappearing in the mountains to the great consternation of his court. Until now, we have had no way to know for certain how far back this story goes prior to Ferdowsi. Since the Kefalaya manuscript can be dated to the end of the 4th century and the text it contains almost certainly belongs to the late 3rd century, we now know that the legend dates back at least to the beginning of the Sassanid era. Even in the Shahnameh version, we can see the tension between Khusro's ascetic and world-denying attitude and typical Iranian affirmations of world, family, and society. In the Manichaean version, these tensions appear even more elevated, as Khusro the Blessed, as he's called in this text, proposes to leave behind the world, prompting a strong reaction from his nobles. One of them, named Yuzanes, the son of Tio, represents the familiar character Bizen, or Vizen, son of Gio, found in the same story in the Shahnameh. He asks, "This land to which you will go, is there food and drink in it? Does one marry women there, and do they become pregnant and give birth? Is there gold and silver, war and hunting?" Khusro replies, "There is not a single one of these things in that place. Rather, the one who will go to that land, he will make ambrosia and will neither hunger nor thirst. He will not experience the evils of the body or battles forever." But this life is not for Yuzanes, who replies, "I will not go to that land. You are the one who has loved it. But I will go to Persia, and I will do the things that you have abandoned in that place. I will make war and battle and hunt. Then I will follow you." What follows is Khusro's prediction that Yuzanes will not succeed in having it both ways. And the passage concludes, as it does in the Shahnameh episode, with Yuzanes and others failing to get home, doomed to be lost in the mountains. Two other interesting features appear in this version of the story in the Chesterbeedi Kefalaya. The first is that the inspiration for Khusro's decision to revoke his throne and enter a spiritual quest is a human sage figure named Danan, the son of Danan. And this figure is known from none of the other versions of the Kai Khusro episode that we have in other literature. And so I'd be very happy with any suggestion you might have about this name or the identity of this figure. Also of interest is the ultimate fate of Khusro, always somewhat ambiguous in all versions of his story. Here, you'll note that he climbs a tree into the land of light. The discovery of this earliest witness to Iranian epic certainly has far-reaching implications for our understanding of the history and development of Iranian narrative traditions. To find it in a Coptic text from Egypt adds an extra twist of notability. At the same time, it offers yet another example of how Mani and his early followers engaged with Iranian culture wherever they could and found within it material amenable to their fundamental worldview. Having considered these elements of native Iranian culture in the Chesterbeedi Kefalaya, let us turn now to a few examples of the cosmopolitan conditions in Iran in Mani's time as evidenced by further episodes from the Codex. Michel Tardieu noted a passage in the Chesterbeedi Kefalaya referring to the king of Tehran, known from medieval Iranian Manichaean texts from Turfan, not Tehran. Werner Zundermann likewise pointed out that the codex mentioned the figure Gundesh, who also appears in Iranian Manichaean fragments he had edited. In the Iranian versions of Mani's encounters with these individuals, which derive from a Central Asian context, it was not particularly surprising that Mani was called Buddha. Many Buddhist loanwords appear in the Turfan Manichaean texts and have been viewed as most likely local cultural adaptations. So what is quite surprising is that the same term in the form Buddhas turns up in the Chesterbeedi Kefalaya. And here's the example from the story of the king of Tehran where he calls Mani, he says to Mani, you are Buddha. Clearly, this terminology does not derive from a regional adaptation of the story. And similarly, in the Gundesh material, also found in the Chesterbhiti Kephalaya, compared to a Parthian text that we had previously, we see again the same basic episode occurring and the same references to Mani as both Buddha and apostle in the same way that the Iranian text did, but this in a considerably earlier Coptic text from Egypt. So clearly this terminology, therefore, does not derive from a regional adaptation of the story to local religious culture, but is an original component of Mani's engagement with multiple religious traditions in his own lifetime. In this remarkably cosmopolitan environment of Sassanid Iran, the Gundesh material in our Coptic text goes on at great length. You see that there are several chapters, about a dozen chapters listed up there for the Coptic material covering Gundesh. And this goes on at such length that we speculate that it actually forms a separate hagiographical work that was later incorporated into the Kephalaya when it was assembled. In fact, the Chesterbhiti Kephalaya has several passages where Mani talks about the historical Buddha, as well as a figure named Kabelos, whom Ian Gardner has convincingly argued represents the Kivalan Mahavira, founder of Jainism. He discusses them alongside of Zarathustra, or Zarades, and Jesus, as well as other prophets of the past. Another surprise is the inclusion of the Scythian figure Anacharsis, familiar to us from Greek literature, sometimes included in the lists of the seven sages that are so popular in Greek philosophy. As an outsider figure who visits Greece in this already known Greek literature, he makes some acerbic observations about Greek fondness for wine and sex. So it is understandable that Mani found use for him as another representative of the ancient ascetic wisdom that Mani saw himself carrying forward. Of course, that Mani would know the stories of Anacharsis would seem to indicate the survival of Hellenistic literary and philosophical culture in Mesopotamia even after the devastation wrought on it by the invasion of the Romans in the mid-2nd century CE. In Mani's discussion of these figures of the past in the Chesterbhiti Kephalaya, he systematically situates them in the world around him and affirms their religions as truly founded in an authentic revelatory ascent to heaven. And this is this key passage from Kephalaya in 342. Zarades was sent to Persia. He revealed the truly founded law in all of Persia. Again, Budas, the blessed, he came to the land of India and Kushan. He also revealed the truly founded law in all of India and Kushan. After him again, Orentes came with Kabelos to the east. Jesus Christ came to the west. They were seized from this place. They were taken up. They went, they saw, they came back, they bore witness. They made disciples of the people. Their witness exists until now in their writings in all these countries. In another passage, Mani outlines the common characteristics of each community of followers, giving brief accounts of their founder in a particular geographic location, the organization of the community and the succession of leadership established within it, and the preservation of records of the teachings in various kinds of texts. So he systematically goes through these other religious traditions with these components that are projected up there for you, showing how each of them have these aspects to them. And in this way, he, in essence, provides a concept of what is a religion, what is a religious community, and a concept of religious pluralism in his comparison of them at a time when such religious identities were just emerging in the world, in place of previous assumptions that religion was always inextricably tied to ethnicity. Of course, Mani himself lays claim to all of these traditions as their successor and perfecter, such as in this text from Kephalaya 154, which is actually in the earlier volume, the Berlin Kephalaya. The writings, wisdom, apocalypses, parables, and psalms of the earlier churches are from all parts reunited in my church to the wisdom which I have revealed to you. As a river is joined to another river to form a powerful current, just so are the ancient books joined in my writings, and they form one great wisdom such as not existed in preceding generations. Now, we cannot miss the idea of supersession in his view of his own mission. And this same idea would later be taken up by Islam. But it is not a negative supersession. It is not an eradication and replacement of all that went before. Instead, it is an affirmation of the value and worth of these religions and the idea that together they constitute a greater whole of spiritual knowledge. Beyond the details of such specific episodes of the Codex, it is time for us to draw a few conclusions about the significance of this text for how we approach religious history in this time and region. The Kefalaya provides a revolutionary breakthrough in our knowledge of pre-Islamic Iranian religious culture, illuminating the place Iran held as a dynamic crossroads of cultural interchange between the Mediterranean West and the Indian East. It serves to dispel the myth of a cultural divide between the Greco-Roman world and South and Central Asia prior to the rise of Islam. Global engagement is not a uniquely modern phenomenon, but has been a force in human history for millennia. Contact between the West and East has deeply impacted the histories of both cultural spheres in ways we're only beginning to understand. This earlier case of a globalized religious economy must be brought into consideration in the fields of history, religious studies, philosophy, and area studies. The next generation of researchers cannot afford to treat these regions in isolation. They must acquire the linguistic skills and broad historio-cultural background that will allow them to see contact and connections between India and Rome, Egypt, and Iran. These connections must be carefully established, of course, and channels of transmission identified, and the movement of people and ideas better understood. Within this broader crossroads of cultures across the region, the Chester Beatty Kefalaya promises to illuminate pre-Islamic Iranian religion specifically. There has been a major void in our knowledge of late antique Iran. We have no proper idea of the form taken by Zoroastrianism in the 3rd century, and scholars remain fundamentally divided over basic issues of reconstruction and interpretation. Aside from a handful of terse inscriptions and the reports of Greek geographers and historiographers, there is virtually no other extant textual evidence on religion from Iran in this period. We now have, with the Chester Beatty Kefalaya, a fixed reference point, providing a means to check various theories of conditions and development in late antique Iran. Indeed, what sources we have for the development of not only Zoroastrianism, but also Judaism, Mandaism, and even for Christianity are often strikingly insular, closed in on internal scholastic debates rather than informative about religion on the ground and in contact with neighboring traditions. The Codex breaks through these limitations, providing direct testimony to its own era with attention to interreligious engagement. The decipherment of this text, therefore, constitutes a breakthrough in the study of pre-Islamic Iranian religion. There is nothing in the Dublin Kefalaya's Western provenance to detract from this significance. By comparison of passages with close parallels preserved in medieval Iranian manuscripts from Turfan, it is possible to reconstruct the shared historical references between these widely separated sources. The assumption that the Coptic and presumably prior Greek translation of this material entailed a substantially westernized perspective cannot be upheld. It contains specific Iranian and Indian terminology never before known in a Western source from antiquity, and suggests that the Codex will be equally illuminating on the state of Indian religion in the 3rd century. The exact path by which this material made its way to Egypt, through what personal and linguistic intermediaries, remains uncertain. Given Mani's close connections to the Mesopotamian city of Al-Madain, or Seleucia, where a substantial Hellenistic cultural tradition still thrived close to his lifetime, it is conceivable that a Greek edition of the Kefalaya collection was produced already there in Mesopotamia and subsequently translated into Coptic. Yet certain Iranian personal and place names in the Codex could not have been transmitted through a Greek version, but would have to have passed directly from Syriac to Coptic. The evidence of the recent discoveries of Kelis show that this was completely possible. The Manichaeans made use of established channels of trade and communication between Iran and the Roman East. And the Chester Beatty Kefalaya provides a dramatic demonstration of how extensive the exchange of knowledge between cultures was. Mani and the Manichaeans played an active role in this cultural exchange, not only between Iran and the West, but also between Iran and Central and East Asia, as we are learning from new discoveries originating from China. And this is an example of one of those recently discovered Chinese paintings which have been found in Japan in the last decade. I truly believe that we are entering a new era of understanding ancient globalism, and it is my hope that it may offer some constructive insights into modern globalism, especially the lesson of Mani's relatively tolerant, affirming view of religious pluralism. Now that I have built up this codex in your estimation and expectations, let me add a final cautionary qualification. The text is highly fragmentary. Broken passages often offer only tantalizing terms and phrases. The full range of photographic techniques have been brought to bear to make it more readable. Even so, we have lost far more from this codex than we have recovered. It gives us very valuable new points of data, but it will not solve all questions or even a fraction of current questions about late antique religion. But even small steps forward are welcome in this difficult but fascinating field. Thank you.